From the Stanley and Dorothy Trolson Lecture Hall in Omaha's Durham Western Heritage Museum, Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Western Heritage Museum Lecture Series. In an event co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council, we'll hear a presentation entitled Nebraska in Song and Story with Dan Holtz, professor of English at Peru State College in Peru, Nebraska. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, March 25, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Western Heritage Museum, the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Western Heritage Museum.
Helping us celebrate Nebraska statehood this evening is Dr. Dan Holtz. A native Nebraskan from Ord, Dr. Holtz is a professor of English at Peru State College, where he has taught since 1987. Dr. Holtz has presented his Nebraska through song and story program throughout the state. He has performed at the state capitol, the Nebraska State Historical Museum, Scottsbluff National Monument, the Joslyn Art Museum, the Bob Devaney Sports Center for the state quarter launch in April of 2006, Fort Robinson, and the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., July of 1999. In November of 2002, he released a CD of the songs he sings titled Welcome to Historic Nebraska. Not only has Dr. Holtz crossed the state many times by car, he's also traveled across it by bicycle as an eight-time veteran of the bicycle ride across Nebraska. Most impressively, he was also a Wheel of Fortune television show bonus round winner. That's the one I want to talk to him about later. Dr. Holtz lives in Nebraska City with his wife, Alice, and they have two sons. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Dan Holtz and the Nebraska Through Song and Story.
Good evening. First of all, I want to thank Mick and the Durham Western Heritage Museum for having me here. This is a great facility. I had not been in here, at least in the auditorium, until today, so I was really impressed and surprised to see this. And then I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight to listen to some songs and stories about the early days in Nebraska. As Mick noted, I've been across the state many times in a number of different capacities. One of the things that he didn't get a chance to mention is that I do with my colleague who teaches Nebraska history at Peru State, we do a thing called the Trails and Tales Tour. And it's a two-week experience where mostly teachers come in to study Nebraska literature and history concurrently. And then the second week we take to the road, and we're doing it again this summer. We're doing a thing that focuses on Plains Indians. And so if you're interested in that, it's possible to take the tour rather than actually taking any of the academic credit if there are spots left. And I actually see one person who has a brochure kind of straight out in front of me here. But just a mention of that. And then my son, whom I'm sure a lot of you saw out there, not recognizing maybe he was my son, is out there selling CDs, so I'll do the shameless commerce before I get into the program. It's been a lot of fun doing this program because, like I said, I've gotten to go to every county in Nebraska, many of them more than one time, numerous times. And when you do that, you see some interesting things about Nebraska, things that I probably would not have seen. And it reminds me of a time that I was going out to Shadron, and I had stopped at Mullen on Highway 2, right in the heart of the sand hills. And I'm sure that a number of you have probably gone through Mullen. If you're going out to Alliance and you take Highway 2, that's the only way you pretty much can go. Well, anyway, I stopped at Mullen, and I was eating lunch at a little cafe on the highway called Big Red's. And I haven't been through there for a while, so I don't know if Big Red's is still there. But it is still there. Okay, anyway, as I was eating lunch, I looked across the highway, and there was an outhouse in a vacant lot there. And I could see that there was a sign on the door, but from where I was, I couldn't exactly make out what the sign said. And so when I got done with lunch, I kind of ambled across the highway, and as I got closer, I could see that the sign said, "Such and such a fella for sheriff," and I, of course, don't remember his name anymore. But then it also said, "Campaign headquarters in the basement." And in a political year like this, particularly with some of the things that have gone on, of course, I guess they always go on, I think that's appropriate. But another thing that comes to mind to me, too, was with bicycle riding. And we've stayed overnight a couple of times on Bran in Callaway. And Callaway is in kind of the heart of Custer County. It's very beautiful out there. I mean, they have tremendously large hills, and, you know, they're sort of studded with cedar trees, which I know can be a pest to ranchers and farmers. But it's a very beautiful area. And the very first time I rode on Bran, I found out that there was a hill not far from Callaway called Democrat Hill. And before I tell you the rest of this, I do want you to know that I'm a registered Democrat. You know, I'm one of the outlaws in this red state, I guess. But anyway, you know, I was interested in that. I'm always interested in knowing kind of the story behind it. And Democrat Hill, of course, obviously it has a name. And if you're on a bicycle and a hill has a name, you know it's trouble. You know it's got to be big, otherwise they won't name it. And, you know, I can think of Blackbird Hill in northeast Nebraska, up by the Omaha and Winnebago reservations. That's a very big hill. But Democrat Hill is one of the few hills in Nebraska where you can't see the top of the roadway from the bottom. And it's not really because it's so tremendously long and steep. I mean, it is long and steep, and I remember puffing and huffing to get my way to the top. But it's because the road winds, and you lose the top of the road from the bottom. But what I found out was this, that Democrat Hill was named after a particular Democratic state administration, and I never did find out the exact years, but a particular Democratic state administration that the people in Custer County or around Callaway thought was particularly long and crooked. So tonight I want to sing some songs of the early days in Nebraska. All of these, except probably for one, will be folk songs that people sang during the 1850s, the 1860s, 1870s. And I'll tell you some stories that kind of go behind these, too. So kind of sit back and imagine you're in the early days in Nebraska here, as we do Nebraska through song and story. And it's going to seem a little bit strange because the first song I'm going to do is called "O California." And I do that song because it's about the 49ers. It's about people coming across Nebraska headed for the gold rush out in California. And like so many folk songs, it's a borrowing. It takes its melody from "O Susanna." And so if you get inspired, you know, I won't mind if you actually want to sing along on the chorus, because all it does is go, "O California, that's the land for me. I'm bound for San Francisco with my washbowl on my knee." Journey on our way. along the California Trail to fields of gold to stay. There's plenty of gold in the world, we're told, on the banks of that distant shore. And how 'twill sound when the word goes round that our pockets are filled with ore. Oh, California, that's the land for me. I'm bound for San Francisco with my washbowl on my knee. I soon shall be in Frisco, and there I'll look around. And when I see the gold lumps there, I'll pick 'em off the ground. I'll scrape the mountains clean, my boys, I'll drain the rivers dry. A pocket full of rocks bring home, oh brothers, don't you cry. Oh California, if you want to sing, that's the land for me. I'm bound for San Francisco with my washbowl on my knee. I'm going to do the chorus one more time. Oh, California, that's the land for me. I'm bound for San Francisco with my washbowl on my knee. Thank you very much. Now, you don't have to be like the students in my classes and look to see if anybody else is singing. If you feel like the Spirit's moving you, you know, just go ahead and belt it out. You know, these people probably don't know you anyway. They don't know me, so what the heck? You know, we can escape here in a little bit and get out of this. That song, Pocket Full of Rocks Bring Home, I'll Pick Up Nuggets Off the Ground. I mean, that was obviously great optimism, which didn't pan out, to use a, you know, kind of a bad pun there. I guess it sort of reminds me of kind of the lending agencies in this, this mortgage crisis that we had. Too much optimism. But in the first verse of that song, I sang, I come from Independence. And I'm talking about Independence, Missouri, because that was the queen city of the trails. In the 1840s, 1850s, it became a hub of activity until those trails, those hubs, you know, moved farther north, and actually Nebraska City, where I live, became a hub of the trails. But if you went from Independence out to San Francisco or out to California, you're going over 2,000 miles. And these people in their covered wagons or on horseback would usually make that trip in about 5 months. They'd go about 15 to 20 miles a day, day after day. And you wanted to leave, say, in late April, early May. You wanted the grass to be growing, you know, so you could feed your livestock as you went along. And you wanted to get started early enough so you didn't get caught in any kind of snowstorm or something like that out west. But I say they went 15 or 20 miles a day. Well, the real question is, how did they know, you know, that they'd gone 15 or 20 miles a day? Some of you, I think, are probably familiar with the Mormons, who were very ingenious, and they actually hooked up some very ingenious odometers on their wagons, and they had them hitched to the axle. And if you go up to the Mormon Pioneer Memorial, you can see an example, a replica of that kind of odometer. But lots of pioneers didn't have that, so here's what they did to figure out the 15 or 20 miles. They would take a piece of cloth, a piece of colored cloth, and they would tie it to one of the spokes of a wagon wheel, okay? Probably the lead wagon, something like that. And then they would measure the distance around the wheel. And if you're following what I'm talking about, then if they're going to figure this out, then all day long somebody has to walk beside that wagon and count the number of times that the wheel went around. And they actually did this, you know, believe it or not. And I can't imagine a more boring job than that. I mean, I've graded hundreds of thousands of freshman comp papers, but I think, you know, this would probably be even more tedious at times. And, you know, I make a joke of that. But anyway, there's a story that in the early days of Nebraska, you know, they had a really good day, this particular wagon team here. And they not only made 15 miles, they not only made 20 miles, they made about 22 miles. And oftentimes it would be a young kid who would get that job of watching the wheel go round and round and round all day. And so can you imagine this poor kid, you know, watching that hour after hour, and, you know, by the time you're looking at that thing and your head is going around and it's spinning and spinning, and by the end of the day, you know, that poor kid was so dizzy he could barely stand up after watching that wheel for 22 miles. You know what they had to do to cure him? They had to back up 22 miles and let him watch it go the other way. Yeah, as you might imagine, there were lots of trail songs the early days of Nebraska, because there were lots of people going across. I mean, they went across the Oregon Trail, the California Trail. They went other trails. But I want to sing a song about what I think are some of the most interesting people to go across the trails, and just because of one of their means of conveyance. And I'm going to sing about the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And I've already mentioned the Mormon Pioneer Memorial, but if you go up there, you can see a replica handcart. And early in their history, you know, 1848 on, the Mormons were using, like everybody else, they were using wagons. But they were getting a lot of converts from places not only in the United States, but in Europe, France, Denmark, England, so on and so forth. And it simply got to a point where they didn't have enough money to outfit everybody with a wagon. So they started building hand carts. And if you've not seen one, it's a two-wheeled cart. It has wheels kind of like those, pretty much like those on a covered wagon. But then it has a bed or a box that'll be about 3 or 4 foot wide and about 4 or 5 foot long, sitting over those two wheels. And sideboards about 8 to 10 inches. And then it has kind of a drawbar thing in front that you can get behind, you know, and push and pull this cart. And they'll hold about 500 pounds if they're fully loaded. But here's a question for you. Who do you think went faster over the Overland Trails, people in covered wagons or people pushing and pulling hand carts? Yeah, it was the hand carts, and they could go about 30 miles per day, you know, on a good day. And I've ridden, for example, in an ox-drawn covered wagon, and oxen just plod along, and they were the most popular means of livestock. You know, they were hardier, sturdier than horses, and so, you know, 15 to 20 miles a day, that's about all they could do. Well, anyway, from 1856 to 1860, you had about 3,000 men, women, and children, Latter-day Saints, who went either from the Florence area of North Omaha, or they went from Iowa City out to the Salt Lake area during those years. And they sang this song. I mean, there are records of these folks singing this particular song called the Handcart Song. So I want to share a little bit of that with you. Yourselves for many more to leave behind your native land, for sure God's judgments are at hand. For you must cross the raging main before the promised land you gain, and with the faithful make a start to cross the plains with your hand carts. For some must push and some must pull as we go marching up the hill. So merrily on the way we go until we reach the valley, oh. The lands that boast of modern light, ye know are all as dark as night, where poor men toil and want for bread, where peasant hosts are blindly led. These lands that boast of liberty, ye ne'er again would wish to see. When you from Europe make a start to cross the plains with your handcart. And long before the valley's gained, we will be met upon the plains with music sweet and friends so dear, with fresh supplies our hearts to cheer. And then with music and with song, how cheerfully we'll march along and thank the day we made a start to cross the plains with our hand carts. For some must push and some must pull as we go marching up the hill. So merrily on the way we go until we reach the valley, oh. So merrily on the way we go until we reach the valley, oh. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. That to me is a very lilting, you know, kind of happy song. And the reality of that experience a lot of times had to be a lot different than kind of the optimism of that song. And Mari Sandoz, one of Nebraska's great writers, wrote about the handcart pioneers in one of her books called Love Song to the Plains. And in that book she wrote, "The first group was largely Danish," this was in 1856, "with no knowledge of English and no experienced leader." You know, and like I said, you had people coming directly from places in Europe, you know, getting on a ship, coming by train as far as they could, and then starting out with these hand carts. Well, she went on to write, the able hurried on as though Salt Lake were just beyond the coming sundown. The rest were strung out in a long, pathetic line, the heavy hand carts blistering their hands, galling their shoulders. And if you think about this, in 1856, this is 11 years before Nebraska becomes a state. And if you can imagine getting out to a place like present-day North Platte or Scotts Bluff, where there's not a tree to be seen in most places, where there aren't established towns, where there aren't roads, where there aren't people, and you've got these people coming from Denmark, and it had to have seemed like the back of the moon to them, you know, just so strange and unusual. Well, Sandoz also writes, that year, 1856, more than 150 of the last 500 died of cold and hunger and heartache, a tragic occurrence exceeded only by the reckless Donner Party some 10 years earlier. And the Donner Party obviously was such a sensational story that everybody knows about that, but I'm not sure if many people know about, you know, what befell these handcart pioneers. And it was kind of a similar cause. You know, they figured they could probably go faster than people in covered wagons, but they got started really late. Remember that I said covered wagon pioneers, they like to start in the spring. Well, these two companies of handcart pioneers got started in August, but they didn't have as far to go, and they thought they could make it. Well, they got out near present-day Casper, Wyoming, and were hit by a sudden Wyoming blizzard. And obviously, before they could be rescued, many of them perished out there. But I wanted to share that story, and I want to share one other trail story that's quite a bit different. And it has to do with one of the most colorful things of going across Nebraska in the early days. And these weren't actually pioneers. They were mail carriers. And I'm talking about the Pony Express. And I like to talk about this because in Nebraska City, I'm trying to get people down there, again, some shameless commerce, I guess, but there's a place called the Old Freighters Museum. Anybody ever been to the Old Freighters Museum in Nebraska City? My son has, okay. But I would encourage you to go there because this is an enterprise that was started in the late 1850s by a company where the last names of the men were Russell, Majors, and Waddell. And they ran a very prosperous freighting company out of Nebraska City. In fact, in their peak year in 1865, they shipped about 50 million pounds of freight out of Nebraska City, out to mining camps and army posts in the West. And that became a real jumping off point on the trails. But they also, as I said, these guys ran the Pony Express, and they lost almost as much money running the Pony Express as they made running their freighting business. It just about busted them. But whether you worked for the freighting company or the Pony Express, you had to take an oath before you could get a job, because Majors, one of the partners there, was very religious. And when you signed on, if you got a job, one of the first things they did was they gave you a Bible that you were supposed to carry with you. But you also, as I said, had to take this oath. And I want you to imagine for a minute, if you can, that I'm Johnny Fry. Johnny Fry was the first Pony Express rider who rode out of St. Joe, Missouri in April of 1860. He was 20 years old. Most of these Pony Express riders were young men, late teens, early 20s. Buffalo Bill Cody worked for the Pony Express when he was 13. I don't know, the history's kind of shaky on it, whether he ever actually rode for the Pony Express or just worked for them, but he did work at 13. So anyway, I'm Johnny Fry. Do hereby swear before the great and living God that I will under no circumstances use profane language, that I will drink no intoxicating liquors, and that I will not quarrel or fight with any other employee of the firm, and that I will so direct all my acts as to win the confidence of my employers. And, you know, I'm thinking about these Pony Express riders, these guys in their late teens. But more so, I'm thinking about these Teamsters, you know, who are driving cantankerous oxen early in the spring, and they're not going to swear. You know, and they get out on the trail there, and they're not going to take a little nip, you know. I find that a little hard to believe. But anyway, they did take that oath. And if you you go to the Old Freighters Museum, you can see an example of it. So I want to sing a song about the Pony Express, and this is my composition. I looked for a long time for a Pony Express song. I thought I could find lots of them because that's such a romantic part of our history, but I didn't. And so I decided to write one. This is called the Writer's Refrain. And those riders would ride about 75 to 100 miles a day, and you're out in the middle of nowhere. And I always wondered, what would you think about, you know, during that 75 to 100 miles? And so this is kind of what this song is intended to do. These are maybe some of the things they thought about. This old Mustang's pulling at the bit the moat. Sheila's draped over the saddle. I've got 10 miles to the next relay. It's a dry, dusty, uphill battle. Another 10, and after that, I'll reach the home station. Get a warm bed and a hot biscuit. Wait to make my eastbound run. Seen the chimney for the last half hour as I'm riding along the Platte River. Prairie dogs bark, the sun climbs higher. I'm glad it burned off my shiver. Lonely life out on the plains. The sky is my best friend. My best girl's waiting in St. Joe, wondering when this road will end. Some say I'm not much more than a kid, though I've seen my share of hard living. You grow up fast on a dry land claim that's as close to hell as to heaven. I ride all day, and if need be, I'll ride on through the night. The stars may shine or they may fade out, but the mail must get through right. The meadowlark sings as I pass by, sure wishing I could fly with him. Hooves pounding time on this hard-packed ground, my eyes are burning, my back is aching. But 50 a month is good pay. Can't rustle that much back home. My pony can outrun any engine, and I got a good six gun. This old Mustang's pulling at the bit. This old Mustang's pulling at the bit. Well, you would probably think from listening to my program so far that nobody ever actually stayed in Nebraska, because I've been singing songs about people going through Nebraska. Well, right after the Pony Express shut down in 1861, about a year later, the federal government passed the Homestead Act. You could get 160 acres of land just about for free. It wasn't totally free, but almost for free. And if somebody were to give us 160 acres of Nebraska farmland today, man, that would be great, wouldn't it? Just for free. But anyway, you had a lot more people who started to stay in Nebraska to build businesses, to build lives, and, of course, to build homes for themselves. And if they were near the Missouri River like we are tonight, they could have built a log cabin. There were plenty of trees here, a lot of timber. But you get farther out west, and in most places you only had trees along the creeks and the riverbanks. You just didn't have them out there. And so they had to have a different solution, a thing they called prairie marble. And, of course, I'm talking about sod houses. And I want to sing a sod house song. It's called Starving to Death on a Government Claim. And there are quite a few sod house songs, and they kind of take that bent to them because they sort of chuckle, you know, at the hard times, what it was like to live in a sod house. And I've been fortunate. I've had the opportunity to talk to more than one person who grew up in a sod house. And one of the most memorable ones for me is a guy named Curtis Douse. He grew up in the Douse sod house, as it's called. And it's out in Custer County. It's very near a little town called Comstock. And if you don't know where Comstock is, if you know where Broken Bow is, Comstock isn't too far from Broken Bow. And that house was built in the year 1900. And one time when I was talking to Curtis about, you know, living in the house, he said that one evening he was in the kitchen and he was helping his mom make supper. And from the room next to the kitchen, and I'm telling you something here about his sod house that was kind of unusual in a way, that it had more than one room. In fact, it had four rooms. And a lot of the early sod houses only had one room. And it might be 18 by 24 feet or 20 by 30 or something like that. You know, and I always like to talk to kids about that. You know, could you imagine living with your whole family in a house that was only 20 by 30 feet? You didn't have television. You didn't have, you know, video games. You didn't have a microwave and all that stuff and so on and so forth. And they just kind of scoff at me. But anyway, that's what it was like. But he said he was helping his mom make supper. And what do you think they saw coming out of a crack in the wall? It was a snake. And that snake started slithering across the floor in that room. Well, what do you think Curtis's mother did when she saw that snake? Did she scream and jump up on the kitchen table? Of course not. She was a tough pioneer woman. She'd seen plenty of snakes. It wasn't a rattlesnake. It was just a bull snake. And besides, I said that she was cooking supper, and she just happened to have the butcher knife in her hand. So she went and chopped that snake right in half, and then threw him into the stew for the evening meal. And, of course, the last part isn't true, but the rest of it is. So here's a little bit of starving to death on a government claim. And think about living in your sod house and, you know, putting up with these kinds of critters. And that's really what a lot of this song is about, putting up with critters in your sod house. And I think I better jack this up a little bit of a key here. Oh, Frank Baker's my name, and a bachelor I am. I'm serving old Batch on an elegant plan. I'm getting messed up here. You'll find me out here in the county of Lane, a starving to death on a government claim. Oh, my house is constructed of natural soil. The walls are erected according to Hoyle. The roof has no pitch but is level and plain, and I never get wet till it happens to rain. So hurrah for this county, the land of the free, the home of the grasshopper, bedbug, and flea. I'll holler its praises and sing of its fame while starving to death on a government claim. How happy I feel when I crawl into bed and a rattlesnake rattles a tune at my head. And the gay little centipede, void of all fear, crawls over my neck and down into my ear. And the little bedbugs, so cheerful and bright, they keep me a-laughing two-thirds of the night. And the gay little flea with sharp tacks in his toes plays "Why Don't You Catch Me" all over my nose. So hurrah for this county, hurrah for the West, where farmers and laborers are ever at rest. For they've nothing to do but sweetly remain and starve like a man on a government claim. Anybody recognize that melody? It's a very well-known melody. I do it in a slower tempo than you're used to hearing it in. But again, it's just an example of how these folk songs borrow. You're probably used to hearing it in about this tempo. And that is called by some people the Irish jig, and by other people it's called the Irish washerwoman. But again, folk songs do that much of the time. You know, thinking about sod houses, it reminds me of another little story. A woman named Lena Hatter, and she and her husband were German. They had come out to Nebraska to settle kind of in northeast Nebraska near a little town called Howells. And I don't know if anybody in here is familiar with Howells, but it's not too far from West Point. And like a lot of pioneer families, or at least some of them, sometimes the husband would come first, and he'd get the homestead kind of in order, and then the wife would come later, and that was the case here. And so Lena, she came on a train all the way to West Point, and her husband picked her up with the buckboard, and they headed off toward Howells to their homestead out there. And the husband had written that he'd build a house for them. Didn't say what kind of house it was. And she kind of had in her mind, you know, this nice white frame house, you know, sort of like you might see in Germany. Well, when she got there, of course, it was a sod house, you know, and she was kind of a little broken up about that and a little bit in tears. But then she looked at the house, and she saw in the front that it had two doors, you know. And so she knew, or at least she thought, that, hey, at least there are two rooms in that house. It's not just one room. And so she headed toward the wider of the two doors, and her husband stopped her and said, don't go in there. That side's for the livestock. Now, not only did you have to put up with critters and livestock in your sod house, you had to put up with something else in this sea of grass that so many of our writers wrote about. In fact, Willa Cather, in probably her most beloved book, My Antonia, she wrote from the perspective kind of Jim Burden, you know, who was sort of the narrator in that story. And he came out to Nebraska from Virginia, and he's, you know, in a wagon heading out toward his family's, his grandparents' homestead at night. And he peeks out from under the blanket that he's got over him in the back of the wagon, and he thinks, there seemed to be nothing to see. No fences, no creeks or trees, no hills or fields. There was nothing but land, not a country at all, but the material out of which countries are made. And part of that material, which particularly has to do with sod houses, was a fragrant fuel that the pioneers, the settlers, variously called buffalo wood, Nebraska oak, or my favorite one, Hereford coal. Hereford coal. And, of course, I'm talking about cow chips. And, you know, not only did they burn these things to heat their sod houses, even though they were warm in winter and cool in summer, they also sang about burning cow chips. So here's the song, Cow Chips. How dear to the eyes in the land of Nebraska, where coal can't be bought and wood isn't found, where ozone is fresh as it is in Alaska, are the big piles of cow chips that lie on the ground. The fire kindling cow chips, the hash cooking cow chips, the corn saving cow chips that scattered around. How ardent we seize them. Yes, we really do. With eyes that are glowing, and say to ourselves that they cook very well. You know, just think about it. If you were cooking with cow chips, you wouldn't need Mrs. Dash or salt and pepper. Just anything, you know? And then when we're waiting and punching and blowing, how rich are the fumes that arise to the smell. The needful old cow chips, the odorous cow chips, the hash cooking cow chips, so rich to the smell. When crops are a failure and stock is a dying, and corn for our fuel cannot then be found, when hauling our water we're freezing and crying, how welcome the cow chips that out here are found. The genuine cow chips,
the bona fide cow chips, the pure-blooded cow chips that out here are found. The genuine cow chips, the bona fide cow chips, the pure-blooded cow chips that out here are found.
Thank you so much. That's a fun song to do. I get to do this program a lot for fourth graders because they study Nebraska history. And, of course, you know right away what song they like the best. You know, oh, cow chips, ooh, that's really cool. But then I say to them, well, you know, who do you think got to pick up those cow chips? You know, you think your parents were going to go out and do that? And then, of course, I kid them. I'm not sure they always understand this, but I say, just think about if you had to pick them up and they were newly minted, you know? And, of course, you couldn't do that, but anyway. I want to sing a song here that Roger Welsh says maybe should be Nebraska's official state song. And, of course, it's not. Beautiful Nebraska, which I think is a beautiful song, is our state song, and it became our state song on our centennial in 1967. And some of you may have been, you know, paying attention that there's been kind of some call for maybe a different, you know, state song. But I hope Beautiful Nebraska stays as our state song. But this one could be our state song because of its title. It's called Nebraska Land. But I think maybe even more appropriately, it could be our state song because it's about Nebraska's weather. And, you know, if there's a topic that Nebraskans like to talk about other than Nebraska football or maybe the, you know, the livestock markets or whatever, it's weather. We love to talk about weather because it's changeable. And, you know, I actually know meteorologists who just kind of go in euphoria if they get stationed in Nebraska because, you know, we got all this neat weather that we can track. And, you know, thinking about that, I want to ask you a couple of questions. What do you think, what year was the coldest winter in our state capital? What year did that occur? And I'll tell you that in that winter, there were 37 days where the temperature went below zero. 37, yeah, somebody's got it out there. I heard it. It was 1936. 37 days where the temperature went below zero. And, you know, I'm not just talking 5 below or 10 below. I mean, they were getting down to 20 below, you know, and sometimes even colder than that. Okay, so you know that bit of information. Okay? Well, what year do you think was the second hottest summer on average in Lincoln? And it was also the year when the hottest temperature ever in Nebraska was recorded. Anybody have any idea what that temperature was? It was the same year. Second hottest summer and the coldest winter in the same year. And in that year, 1936 in Lincoln, there were 48 days, count them, folks, when the temperature went above 100 degrees. 48 days. You know, and this was the dirty 30s, the Depression years, and I'm sure some of you have seen these pictures where there were people sleeping out on the Capitol, you know, grounds because it was too hot to sleep inside, or they'd sleep in their front lawns and, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the hottest temperature ever was 118 degrees, 118 degrees, and the coldest temperature ever was 48 below, but it wasn't in 1936. I think that was 1899. But anyway, this song, Nebraska Land, like I said, does deal with our weather. And in the 1890s, Mari Sandoz, you know, and she recalled this in her book, Old Jewels, she said in the early 90s, it was so dry in the panhandle that even the old timers thought that it would never rain again. Because you had drought in 1891. 1893, 1894. And if you can imagine that, trying to struggle along in the panhandle, you know, you didn't have the farm programs to bail you out, didn't have any of that kind of stuff. You had to rely on yourself. And what you saw in the 1890s was kind of an out-migration of population. People said, hey, we've had enough of this. But if you think about this a little bit, in 1854, when Nebraska became a federal territory, that's when it was legal for white people, non-Indian people, to start settling in Nebraska. There were fewer than 1,000 people in the territory. You know, they'd gotten permission from the federal government to come in here to do the fur trade or other things like that. So that's 1854, fewer than 1,000 people. By 1890, there were more than 1 million people in Nebraska, 36 years. Okay, what's our population nowadays? That's about 1.7 million, 1.8 million, right? So we've gained less than 1 million people in over 100 years, and we gained 1 million people in the first 36. You know, kind of an interesting thing. But here's the song Nebraska Land, and think about our weather here. We've reached the land of desert heat, where nothing grows for man to eat. The wind that blows with blistering heat o'er all these plains is hard to beat. We have no wheat, we have no oats, we have no corn to feed our shoats. Our chickens are so very poor, they beg for crumbs outside the door. In Nebraska land, sweet Nebraska land, as on thy burning soil I stand and look away across the plains and wonder why it never rains. Till Gabriel blows with trumpet sound and says the rain has gone around. Now that's obviously a verse about the dry years in Nebraska. But as we all know, occasionally it does rain. So we've got to have a verse about the wet years. And here it is. We have no wheat, we have no oats, we cannot harvest them in boats. Our chickens are too poor to eat, they have no webs upon their feet. Poor little critters. But with a smile upon my lips, I stand in mud up to my hips. Nebraska land, so fertile and rich, we think you are a honey. In Nebraska land, sweet Nebraska land, as on thy sodden soil I stand and look away across the plains and pray to God to stop the rains, and look away across the plains and wonder why it never rains. That's it. Thank you. That's my program for tonight. I really appreciate you being here. You know, I do this program most of the time through the sponsorship of the Nebraska Humanities Council, and I think that, yeah, it's actually back there. Thanks again for being here. I really enjoyed it. Thank you much.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Western Heritage Museum Lecture Series. We've heard a presentation entitled Nebraska in Song and Story with Peru State College Professor of English Dan Holtz. This program, co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council, was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, March 25, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Western Heritage Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the series will be Tuesday evening, April 15th at 6:30. At that time, Brian Kokensparger, Computer Support Coordinator for the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences, will present a program entitled John A. Creighton, Blazing the First Internet. More information on this and other lectures in the series can be found at dwhm.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.